our homeschool journey, I became aware that beauty and an appreciation for art in all its various forms was a really important aspect to our home education, especially because I had artistic children and I wanted to foster that in them. So years ago, I discovered Catholic Heritage curricula and was first introduced to their art appreciation resources for young children in their Art Masterpieces series, which was excellent and we used for a number of years. A desire for deeper understanding led us to the CHC program, Ever Ancient, Ever New. It's a program in two parts. Ever Ancient, Ever New guided us from ancient art forms chronologically to the art of the Renaissance. And then part two leads us from the art of the High Renaissance through the modern era. The first thing that drew me to the art appreciation that they offer is the history and the distinctly Catholic perspective. It was really beautiful. But the program also presents art theory and opportunities to practice with a companion art pad that goes along with the books. CHC materials are always steeped in beauty, and this program is really delightful. It helped us cultivate a sensitivity to beauty, and I think for the children that I used it with, it gave us all the foundation in the eras of art and characteristics that define them. The lives of artists, cultural influences, and the implications of those influences in art are explored in the context of each chapter. Ever Ancient, Ever New can be used independently by children in grades 5 and up, or read together as a family with much younger children. As something we valued in our family, this program makes art appreciation something that parents can share with their children without being overwhelmed by the idea of introducing art. It's beautiful, it's simple and engaging. A link to the program is in the show notes. Have a look and enjoy all of CHC's art programs and all of their beautiful programs as well. Good afternoon to my dear sweet listeners. I just wanted to remind you before I introduce my guest, I'd like to remind you to subscribe to our podcast, leave a comment or a like. We love that stuff around here. I want to especially just take a moment to thank my listeners. For this past week, I have been absolutely inundated with messages of love and condolence and support and prayers. I have, if you don't know what I'm talking about, my last episode was just a little 5-minute episode explaining that my dad died a few weeks ago, very tragically, and we I sort of explain, you know, what happened there to my audience. And I'm just so grateful for your love and support. It's just buoyed me up in ways that you can't even know. So thank you for all of that. And because we're going to be talking about poetry today, I also thought it would be a nice moment to just share with you that my dad, who was, you know, a heavy duty equipment operator, a hunter, a fisherman, a naturalist, a conservationist, he also loved poetry, and he used to memorize poetry and recite poetry to us. And, what a gift to be given as a child. I know that that was a gift for me to have a father who appreciated poetry and beauty, particularly Robert Service, of course, who's a Canadian poet. I just thought I should share that with you guys. So I have a guest today that you should all know and love. And if you don't know him and love him, what the heck, right? Joseph Pierce joins me today to discuss a new book he's written about poetry for children. So thank you for that. It's just incredible. And welcome, Joseph. It's amazing that you've produced this. I'm loving it. I'm totally loving it. I've read half of it. So
thank you.
Incredible. And honestly, I'm really honored to be asked to do this interview from town. We've done another interview in the past. And this particular interview, the gal from TAN reached out and asked if I would do it. I thought, oh, poetry? Yeah, right up my alley. So I'd love to do that. But I feel like I'm so privileged to be interviewing you. I feel like I'm interviewing one of the C.S. Lewis's of our era. And I'm so grateful for this. So thank you for taking the time and for all that you do. It's quite an amazing gift to us as Catholics and just as human beings, for sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So before I introduce you, let's just start with a quick prayer here. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Heavenly Father, just thank you for this moment to spend with Joseph and to share his knowledge and wisdom with my listeners. I just ask that you can guard all our conversation, that you allow it to be a conduit of love and tenderness and knowledge and mercy, and for the purpose of growing closer to you. We specifically ask the intercession for this interview of your beloved Our Lady of Fatima. Pray for us. And St. Thomas Aquinas, pray for us. And St. Philip Neri,
pray for us.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Thank you. So, by way of introduction, Joseph Pierce is a British author, publisher, editor, instructor, now living in the U.S. You've been in the U.S. for quite some time.
Right. I moved here 4 days before 9/11, so September the 7th, 2001. A good baptism of fire.
Etched in your brain. Wow. Okay. And so how I know you is that you've done many books and commentaries on sort of our literary giants from the past and modern, lots of literary commentary from your critical editions that you've published with Ignatius. And as an instructor, you've got courses on EW10 and with Homeschool Connections, which is how we met initially, because my daughter was taking a Dante course with you through Homeschool Connections. So is there any other works that you are doing or that are up and coming that you'd like to sort of share with my audience that would be interest specifically to our homeschool parents?
Well, I just really mentioned that I had my next book, which will be coming out in a few months with Ignatius Press, is called The Good, the Bad, and the Beautiful, History in Three Dimensions. So it's a history of Christendom.
Oh, wow.
With one chapter for each century since the time of Christ. So I'm very excited about that. And so that's coming out soon. So maybe keep an eye out for that.
Okay, that's fantastic. So the other thing that my listeners may not know is that you are also a homeschooling dad, which of course becomes exceptionally relevant to us as a homeschooling dad and what you do and the worldview that you are that you're working with. So I think that that means a lot. I should know this, but I don't actually know. Have you written your own conversion story?
I did. I wrote a book called Race with the Devil, right. My Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love. It was published by Tan Books. Or St. Benedict Press, which is the same thing as Tan Books,
okay.
Basically. Probably about 10 years ago now, some time back now.
Okay, because our last interview, we talked a bit about your conversion story. And it's a very powerful story, and I thought, oh, I bet you've written about it, but I couldn't remember. So that's fantastic. Your new book is called Poems Every Child Should Know. It's published by Tan. It's beautifully bound. I'm going to show it here. I'm not sure if this will go video, but I'm going to show it here. It's such a beauty. You can see all my bookmarks. beautifully bound in a leatherette. It's a really lovely edition. But it's more than a collection. You've also got introductions for various poets, and some of the entries have things to think about, especially as the poems become sort of more mature. I think that's really important, and I'd like to sort of jump into that a little bit later. You've got a great selection of funny poems, of serious poems, sort of short poems, long poems. I'd like to, before we get into the meat of the book itself, I'd like to kind of ask a big question. So why does poetry matter? And especially for children, why does poetry matter?
Well, first of all, poetry is music. And music matters. Music in the broadest sense of the word, that which is the fruit of the muses. In other words, the fruit of God's creativity. We need to understand, you know, who we are as human beings. We are made in the image of God. We are the imago Dei. There's certain attributes of what it is to be human, which separates us from the rest of the physical creation. One is the ability to love. Goodness, virtue. One is the ability to reason, but the other is the ability to create. God is the creator, the maker. The English, the old English word for to create is to make. The poesis in Greek just means to make. So to be a poet just means to be a creator. So we are called to be creative. We are meant to be making beautiful things. The elves in the Lord of the Rings, people wonder about why is it that elvish things made by the elves are so beautiful? And the elves say, because we put all that we love into all that we make. So this idea that through the grace of God and through the gifts we're given, and the two types of gift that are talents, right? If we've been given five talents in something, we're meant to be using them. But then as well as the talents, the aptitude, the natural gifts we've got, there's the inspiration. And that's a mystical relationship we have with the creator in our own act of creativity. So that's creativity. That's music, the muses in the broadest sense of the word. But in the purely linguistic sense, poetry is how words sing. That basically it's a distillation of language in such a way that the words sing to us. They are not just prosaic, they are poetic. And that means that basically we are being lifted up. And we need to remind ourselves that, you know, that if we are lifted up, if we are edified by something, that's a prayer. Because the definition right. of prayer is lifting up the mind and the heart to God. So even if it's not specifically about God, anything that lifts up our mind and heart is moving our mind and heart in the direction of the divine. So poetry is crucial. And, you know, that Shakespeare says that a man that has no music is fit only for treason, stratagems and spoils. And he had the Puritans in mind when he said that. But the point is, that's also true of poetry. Those people that do not take the time to read poetry are not to be trusted.
Okay, I love that. Yes, I think there's something to this for sure. So can you speak to specifically about the sort of the value of beautiful language patterns going into our brain?
Yes. So basically, you know, beauty. Beauty is the image of the divine. So there's two things about beauty. It's a creative act. Well, let's get a little bit deep here, right? We know that the Greek philosophers spoke about the good, the true, and the beautiful, and we know how Christian philosophy baptizes that in a triune sense as being somehow something which that figures the Trinity, right? Because you can't separate goodness, truth, and beauty. They are three, and yet they're one. So they're triune. Now, goodness is love. So goodness is laying down our lives self-sacrificially for the beloved. So it's a relationship between us and the other. Reason is using our mind to engage with the reality that's out there and make sense of it. So again, it's relationship between us and the subjective and the objective out there. The beautiful is our engagement with God's divine presence in creation and creativity. So when Jesus Christ says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, he is saying I'm the good, the true, and the beautiful. Because the beautiful, beauty is the life in something, and it's a relationship. Because a sunset is beautiful. Some people can't see the sunset because they're not interested in looking at it. The sunset is alive, but to see the beauty requires life in the beholder, and not merely in the thing beheld. So basically, it's not true. It's a lie to say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's not, because the beholder can be blind to beauty. The beauty is in the thing beheld. We have to have the life of grace to see that beauty and have a relationship with it. So basically, we have to see God's creation. So I look out there and see trees, but also our own sub-creativity. We make things, God makes things from nothing, ex nihilo. We make things from other things that already exist. That's sub-creation, to use Tolkien's terminology. But that is part of the divine image. It's God's working through us. We do see the presence of God in beautiful art. And again, in terms of literature, the most beautiful literature of all is poetry.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we can't deny the fact that, you know, when we see children who've been raised with music, who've been raised with nature, who've been raised with beautiful literature, you know, who've been raised with all the aspects of beauty, that affects their life on a level that you can't deny. And their whole life is going to have imprint of beauty on it. There's a book that I'll be mentioning a couple of resources that I've used over the years, because your book wasn't available to me, but I think this book complements the things I used in a way that I wish had been, because it addresses some you know, particularly sort of older kids, I think that's really marvelous for. But the book, there's are you familiar with Andrew Pudua, the Institute for Excellence in Writing?
Well, I've actually heard of the Institute. I don't know the person.
Okay, so Andrew Puder wrote a book called Linguistic Development Through Poetry Memorization. And so one of the things that he comments in it, your answer was incredible, that he speaks to is when beautiful language patterns go into our brain, that is what we're going to see going out of our brain. You know, and I've seen that with my own children, that they've been raised with poetry in an environment of poetry, and they are naturally good writers. They make good word choices. They make good sentence structure. They are, it's just in there. It's not because I'm overhamming them. Oh, this should be better. This should sound better. They know when it doesn't sound beautiful. Right.
Yeah. I tell people, you know, that want to become writers, you know, how do you become a good writer? The rule number one is you only write as well as you read. And the other thing we have to remember, you know, we know it's much easier to remember the words of a song than to remember, you know, a prose transcript.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So because the melody, the rhythm, those things allow us to remember much more easily, which is why poetry is much easier to remember than straight prose. Mm-hmm. So the one thing about that, apart from the beauty of the poetry itself, memorization allows us to increase our vocabulary. Now, and I think the word vocabulary is too abstract, right? I prefer what the Anglo-Saxons used to say. They used to talk about each individual person, not something abstract like vocabulary. Each individual person has their own unique word hoard. In other words, the bag of words they carry around with them, right, in their mind. And every word we learn is real wealth, you know. We can get more gold, and it may or may not be good for us. Gold can actually corrupt us. But every new word that we learn is real wealth, because yes, it allows us, first of all, to articulate reality to ourselves, because we think with words. It allows us to articulate reality to ourselves, and it allows us to communicate that reality to others. So increasing our word hoard, increasing our wealth of words is mm-hmm. crucial. And one of the best ways we can do that is by memorization, and the easiest words to memorize of poems.
Well, absolutely. And the thing about poetry is that you're learning the vocabulary in context. So it's there forever in your brain, you know, and it's like learning a list of vocabulary words. What is that? That doesn't even make sense. We have to apply it. We have to see it in a beautiful context in order for it to stay. It's not going to stay if you don't. You're not going to use it because you won't really understand how.
Absolutely. In fact, in my introduction to Poems Every Child Should Know, I say that I've not burdened the text with footnotes. So when it's a difficult word, you know, there's two things you can do with a difficult word. You can just gloss over it, which is actually fine. I mean, I wouldn't want people to not enjoy a poem because they had to stop every three lines to find out what a word meant. I'd rather them read the whole thing. And you know, the words sort of in there somewhere. When they see it another time, then they begin to make the connections. But the other thing they can do, and they're welcome to, is to look, use it as an adventure to discover new words, to look them up.
Absolutely.
So, you know, to use them, you're reading a poem, there's a word you don't know. I'm not going to provide the footnote, but look it up, because then it becomes an adventure. Mm. You're going looking for it yourself. It's not just put on a plate for you. It becomes your own. You've done the work. You've done the research. It's an adventure. Now, as G.K. Chesterton said, An adventure is an inconvenience rightly considered, right? So that we should just treat the discovery of new words as an adventure.
Beautiful. So I'd kind of like to talk a little bit. So we're talking about poetry in general and poetry as a sign of beauty. But I was wondering sort of what your take is on where does silliness, because you've got a whole section on Hilaire Belloc, who has some very silly poems, and there's many very silly poems that I adore, Ogden Nash and various other poets that are just hilarious. And silly or ridiculous poems, where does that fit into this?
Well, you know, Hilaire Belloc said once in one of his poems, he said, there's nothing worth the wear of winning than laughter and the love of friends. And G.K. Chesterton ends orthodoxy with basically saying that the one thing that Christ did not reveal to us when we walked on earth was his mirth. We have to understand how do we know what the imago Dei is in us? How do we know what the image of God is in us? Well, it's what it is about us that that distinguishes us from rabbits and cows and dogs, right? What is it? So obviously, as we've already said, the ability to love, the rationally choosing to lay down our life self-sacrificially. Reason, working out how far away the sun is from us and how long it takes light to get here. Creativity, writing a sonnet about the sun, right? But the other thing, the fourth, which wasn't revealed by Christ very much, as Chesterton says, is humor. Right? Mm-hmm. Animals don't laugh. There's something divine about laughter. There is a divine comedy. There is a happy ending. And we can be absolutely sure that something as enjoyable as laughter, is going to be lots of it in heaven. So humor is something which is very much part of the Christian life. And of course, humor can be poisoned, the same way that reason can be poisoned. Pride and prejudice go hand in hand, that basically once you have pride, you'll poison everything you touch. You'll poison virtue, you'll poison reason, you'll poison beauty, and you'll poison humor. So any of the good things God gives us can be polluted by us, but it doesn't stop the thing itself from being good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a wonderful answer, incredible answer. I love it. We recently went on a pilgrimage cruise with Foley, Michael and Alexander Foley, who wrote Drinking with the Saints, was the host of this particular, our segment of the cruise. And he did a little presentation one night on merriment. And this is kind of, he's saying a very similar thing. He's saying, you know, as Catholics, we should be pursuing merriment, right? Because there's something social and communal and raising up about merriment, right? And sort of that's something that I see here, sort of that playfulness. Merriment is something that we see in silly poetry, and it draws in children and adults who might not otherwise want to read poetry. They might have a sort of a knee-jerk reaction to that, oh, it's poetry, that's boring. You know, bring them in on a level that's going to be playful.
Absolutely. You know, and another book I wrote fairly recently is called Faith of Our Fathers, A History of True England. And medieval England was called Merry England. And it was called Merry England, you know, it was Catholic. Right. And one aspect of Catholicism was that, you know, on saints' feast days, there were fairs around the country, great celebrations. They had mystery plays. You know, through the period of Corpus Christi, for instance, Corpus Christi is on a Thursday, but it's midsummer. So Corpus Christi would be the opening of a four-day midsummer festival. Wow. So the whole of English culture was basically festooned with festivity connected to the feast days of the saints. So wow. You know, there's a natural merriment that goes with a life of praise. And we need to, if we don't have that naturally, we need to rekindle it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, I mean, we do live in a pretty serious culture, right? There's
ironically, bearing in mind how heathenistic it is, it's a very puritanical culture. It has no sense of humor.
Yes. It's interesting, isn't it? Absolutely. Let's do our part in rekindling that. So what went into this particular collection? Like, how did you come up? Why did you choose these particular poems? Can you sort of explain a little bit about the process?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, that I could not leave out, it would have been sort of a sin of omission to leave out the well-known traditional nursery rhymes from Mother Goose. So there's a part one, which is specifically for younger children, which is the traditional nursery rhymes from the Mother Goose collections, which, you know, poems every child should know. Every child should know Mother Goose. So it's in there, right? Mm-hmm. But the rest of it, which is the bulk of it, is, I say, it's the, every poem is there for children of all ages, including adults who are meant to remain childlike. We will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Nobody should think that poem in the second part, at least, is too simple for them. They're too grown up for it, because if they think they're too grown up for it, it's merely a sure sign they're not grown up enough, right? Because humility is necessary. Right. So I would that the aim was that every poem in the book, except for the Mother Goose, was something that everybody should be able to enjoy. So the parents and children together. And of course, you know, some of the poems might be a bit challenging for younger children, and that's fine. So I say that by all means, younger children, you know, can skip some of the more difficult poems, but older children, including parents, should not skip any of them, because they're all delightful and they all have something to teach us and something to kindle within us.
Beautiful. So when you, were these poems that you sort of raised your own family with, like there was there some that you came across that, oh, I have to include this, or were they all poems that you were personally familiar with?
Well, I mean, I wish I had that level of omniscience. Thank you, Bonnie, for the what I did want to do was to follow the same format of another book I'd done earlier, which is Poems Every Catholic Should Know. So I wanted to arrange the poetry chronologically. And that, there's a good reason for that, because if you start arranging poetry thematically, you know, there's a lot of subjectivity about where a poem should go. And yes, some poems belong in more than one section. So if you just arrange them chronologically and then give a short introduction to each poet, you're also giving the reader, if they decide to read it in that order, of course you don't have to, the beautiful thing about an anthology, you can open it any page and enjoy. But if you choose to read through it methodically, you're actually getting a history of literature and a history of poetry and of poets at the same time, as well as getting the development of culture from, you know, through the ages. So you've got that dynamic going on. But as regards the selection, obviously the poems that I knew already, that I really loved, are in there. But I wondered if you're going to have a title such as Poems Every Child Should Know, then I didn't want it to be Joseph Pierce's selection. You know, I wanted to make sure that it was objectively applicable. In other words, if that's the title, it has to be true, right? Not just, so for instance, I'm pretty well versed in English literature, but I'm not particularly well versed in North American literature. So, you know, so I did make a point of looking through and doing some serious research of some of the best known, best loved children's poetry from North America. And I've included that. So the other good thing about it, from my personal perspective, it actually enriched me. It allowed me to learn many more children's poems than I knew before I began the process of compiling this.
Right. Okay. Well, I was very excited to see Sam McGee in there because I'm Canadian. And of course, Robert Service was a big part of our growing up. But we also, I noticed that you have chosen a lot of poems that I didn't know. Like, and I've been through several volumes of poetry with my own kids. I've been homeschooling for 32 years. And, you know, we know a lot of poetry. We've done a lot of poetry. But I was delighted to see that there was several that I had never come across. And I think that that's, you know, just opens up another door for us, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the other aspect of it, I know that there are great poems that have become forgotten, they've been neglected and then covered in dust or covered in dirt and have been buried. And so another part of the process was, you know, these great gems need to be brought back out, dusted down and represented. So, so yes, there are some poems in there which probably people won't know, but I hope they will agree with me that they are worthy of inclusion because they are as good as the better known poems that they share the space with.
Oh, absolutely. There's a Canadian poet from the sort of, I believe, mid 1800s, whose name is Bliss Carman. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but his poetry is just, there's a few, several Canadian poets that are, most of my listeners are American, but I'm going to mention this anyway. And Bliss Carman, I've only ever found him in one or two volumes of sort of old high school texts from the 30s and 40s. And his poetry just moves me in ways that I can't even imagine. I'm surprised he's not better known. But I thought I'd mention him if anybody wants to look him up. His poetry is really beautiful. We've often used it for dictation because it's so thought-provoking. So I'm going to make a little aside here to my listeners. And the reason I'm going to do that is because I promote dictation a lot. I teach all language arts. I've done it ever since I started homeschooling my kids, except for independent writing. All language arts is taught through the context of dictation. Most of the dictation that we've done over the years, we've done some prose, but the vast majority has been poetry. And I want to, because I've done lots of episodes on that, I just want to point out to them how they might use your book to encourage that, because I get a lot of questions about dictation. So I've done several episodes on the topic, and I'll put them in the show notes for those of you who are kind of new to the idea or new to this podcast. So these little commentaries that you make, not on every poem, and they're short, there's little commentaries made on some of the poems, maybe, I don't know, 30% of the poems, 25% of the poems, on things to think about at the end of the poem. All right. So when I talk about dictation and how during dictation, the first thing we would always do is look up the poet. Well, there's a little biography on each poet that you have. You're making their job way easier, in my opinion, for approaching dictation. So then after we've looked up the poet, we go through the poem together before we ever do dictation. What does this mean in the bigger picture? What does this mean? I wonder what they're talking about. We have some discussion about the meaning of the poem. We create some Socratic dialogue, right? We ask some leading questions. We want to know where the kids are going. And what I talk about a lot is inductive reasoning, looking at the specific to draw conclusions about the general. Now, that can only happen if you immerse yourself in poetry, right? You have poetry as a daily part of your diet. So it's a beautiful way to learn, but we need to sort of look at the specific things and then look at them again and again every day of our life. This is what we do. And we draw beautiful conclusions from what we look at specifically. So we're looking at poetry on the micro scale in dictation. We're looking at it. We're learning the inner workings of language, how language works, the technicality of language, the grammar of language. But we're also looking at the beauty and the purpose of language. And we can't help but doing that when we're doing dictation, when we're reading poetry on a regular basis. So here we have your commentary, Joseph, on really focused on the macro scale. Right, the beauty and the purpose of language, the communication of ideas, the sharing of experience, and that's so valuable. And it's helping the parents learn how to do that because you've got this little these little commentaries and leading questions. So as my listeners move really from sort of grammatical, logical, rhetorical stages, as we sort of go back and forth in those stages of development. Alongside your kids, most of us are, getting a good education for the first time when we homeschool our kids, right? So this is something that to me will be really helpful. So there's lots of help for spelling and punctuation and parts of speech and all of that. This book will move you forward as your kids mature. And I think it's just incredibly valuable and offers something that any other poetry resources that I've suggested in the past, which are all wonderful, this adds a whole new element and absolutely needs a place on your bookshelf. To help you with philosophical ideas and virtue and history and deeper thinking and deeper reading, So thank you for the effort that you've put into it, because I think for us, it's incredibly valuable. My daughter also, I'm just going to mention this resource. My daughter, we prayed some of the breviary prayers together. We only have one child at home now of our seven kids. And, so we've been praying the Liturgy of the Hours, and she, in the back of the breviary, there's a section on Catholic poetry, right? And most of it's quite sort of theological or spiritual, but it's a really nice, there's quite a few poems in there that I think are also really worthwhile to explore. I would like to talk for a moment, if you don't mind, about sort of other resources that you have. I just noticed this. So I went on your website a couple of days ago, and you have a membership program called the Inner Sanctum. And I was wondering if you could explore that with my people, because I think that especially if your kids are 10, 12 and older, I think that this would be an invaluable resource, like a really rich resource, accessible to my people. And so I think it's very reasonable. I think it's $120 a year US, right?
Yeah, they can either pay $10 a month, or they can annual membership for $120 a year.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So just tell us a bit more about it, because I haven't actually joined yet. I will be. Tell us a bit about it. So what people will have access to, because I think it will be a massive addition to somebody's homeschooling as your kids mature, for sure.
Yeah. So basically, I'm very diligent. I can't even remember the last time I missed. So every week, and it's usually on a Friday afternoon. Okay. So the end of the week's a nice way of my having a relaxing end to the working week. I record three new original podcasts, each of about 15 minutes each.
Okay.
And also write an essay. So that's every week, new content. So now I've been doing this for about 5 years, I think. So we're talking about, in the archives, as soon as you join, there are hundreds of podcasts and hundreds of essays that are accessible as soon as you join. There's also, I should say, a 45-part course on C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien that's on there when you join. So apart from the new content, that you have all these archives, but a lot of the archives, the three podcasts every week I do, of which there are now obviously dozens or a couple of hundred or whatever that podcast. I do a poem of the week podcast, so that's very apropos what we're talking about here. And it's not really a poem of the week; it's normally poems of the week, because in 15 minutes, most shorter poems, you can get through several. So I'll comment somewhat, but for the most part, I just want people to enjoy these wonderful poets and these wonderful poems. So we've, you know, over I'm guessing I've now had over 1,000 poems.
Wow. I think
about 163 podcasts, poem of the week podcasts so far, I think, and on average there's got to be 4 or 5. So, you know, it's we're up towards 1,000. And so every week I do a new poem of the week podcast. I also do every week a revisiting old favorites podcast. So, for instance, and that could be anything, that I'm going to read something, but I've read chapters from every one of the books I've written, which is over 30. Wow. And now we're currently going through, I'm reading my contribution to books that I didn't write, but to which I contributed something. So right. Either the foreword or the introduction or a chapter or an essay. So we're working through that. So all sorts of different topics. I've written on all sorts of stuff over the years. And then the third podcast is the Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast, where I just talk about whatever I want to talk about. Do my own thing.
I love that. That's like my podcast.
Yeah, right. So at the moment, we're going on pilgrimage with C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis wrote a wonderful book. It's not one of his best known books, but it's one of my favorites. It's called The Pilgrim's Regress. And basically, it tells of his conversion story in the form of sort of a fictional narrative, a formal allegory, a bit like John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. So we're going through that book with C.S. Lewis, charting Lewis's conversion process, basically. So I've done 6 of those. It's probably going to be at least another 4 or 5 before we finish that. And I'll go do something else. I think we did Chesterton's Orthodoxy. Amazing. Prior to that. So, and then each week I write a Lady Dow diary, which is basically what I'm up to, what I'm doing, both professionally with my writing, teaching, speaking, traveling, but also home life with my family. Yeah. You know, the snakes and other critters that we're living with here in the countryside. So, you know, so that's what I, every week, that's what I do. So I would invite people to consider joining. And my website address is jpearce.co, jpearce.co, not .com, .co. Okay. Just check it out. You know, obviously, I'd love to have you as members.
It's so rich. And I think that, honestly, I just think sometimes when we join something like this, and it's nice that you can do it by the month, so you could try it out for 3 or 4 months and just see if it's something that you're using and using well. I also think that the younger generation, that like you and I are about the same age, but the younger generation, they're way more willing to pay for things that that will help them grow as a person, right? Our generation's not so good at that. But I think that younger people are, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see, you know, that personal growth is so important. And I think that this is not only literary growth, but personal growth when we delve into authors. And I'm mentioning that because I just finished listening to Surprised by Joy, which I have never read. Like I finished it 3 or 4 days ago. Well, I'd had it on every spare moment. The narrator was fantastic. I think there's a few different narrators. I'll put the one that I listened to in the show notes, because I mean, I've known C.S. Lewis. I've read several books of C.S. Lewis, you know, Narnia Chronicles and a couple of his more sort of philosophical books, but I didn't know his conversion story. And Surprised by Joy is this just exceptional conversion story that just, a good conversion story is going to draw you into greater conversion, in my opinion. And I just felt so led to conversion by, you know, his ups and downs. And, you know, we just assume he was always a devout Christian, and there's nothing, not even close, nothing like it.
Yeah. No, he was a devout atheist for many years.
Incredible. So is there a community aspect to the Inner Sanctum?
No, I, you know, unfortunately, because I'm juggling so many balls, wearing so many hats, whichever metaphor we want to use, that I can really only devote, you know, one half day. That's normally it's a Friday afternoon to the website. And if I started engaging with everybody in it, I'd be doing nothing else. So that's the reason I don't do Facebook. And also, I'm a very, you know, I try to practice what I preach. And when I'm at the computer screen most of the day writing or whatever else, editing, whatever else I'm doing, I don't want to spend, you know, the evenings doing social media, quite frankly. Yes. You know, I watch the sunset. I pour myself a glass of something good. I sit out on the deck and watch the sunset. Or spend time with my family. Or read a book. I mean, an old-fashioned book, you know, which actually has pages.
Nice.
This is what I like to do in my leisure time. So, you know, it's difficult. So I do have to limit. So I don't do Facebook. I don't do Twitter. I don't do Instagram. No. I've got some people helping me that do that for me. I do have a Facebook page, although it's not mine. It's in my name. But they post stuff and what have you. But I'm determined not to live my life almost entirely in virtual reality. I want to live it in real reality, and in the real presence of God's creation. So I can't allow myself to get sucked into too much interaction within my website, apart from the fact I'm a technoramus and I wouldn't know how to do it at first. I'd have to learn.
Exactly. Yeah. I do find we're a family that guards our time really, really carefully. And I have to plan times that I don't really interact much on social media, but, you know, just responding to emails and things like that, that's something that, you know, you have to set aside time for, because it could consume you if you allowed it.
Yeah, I would actually say, Bonnie, that I tried. You mentioned C.S. Lewis. I would say this to people that are members of the Inner Sanctum, thinking of joining, that C.S. Lewis made a point always of replying to every single letter that was sent to him. And I try to do the same. So, you know, every time I receive an email, and I receive several emails every day from strangers, that I always make a point of replying. So certainly, you know, if people want to, my email address is on the website. So, you know, if people want to write to me, that's the way to contact me, via email. I will respond to emails. Okay, yeah, correspondence rather than, you know, rather than texting back and forth about small talk.
Yeah, and that's meaningful, because I think that, you know, I appreciate if somebody's emailed me about something and I can respond to that. I feel like it's just so much more meaningful than sort of the light Facebook banter or you know, Instagram banter or whatever. I think that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it just it like texting, for instance, seems to promote laziness in terms of language,
bad grammar,
it's just to me, if it's an interesting conversation, I'd rather meet the person in person. If they're a long way away, I'd rather pick up the phone. I know I'm old, but I don't want to spend too much time either stuck to my phone. So I discourage people texting me, because if I felt obligated to respond instantly to every text I got, I'd be chained to my phone, and I'd be a slave to it. And I don't want to be addicted to technology.
No, exactly. And we have to guard, we really have to guard ourselves. And I think that my particular listeners, I think, are very sensitive to that sort of thing. They're people who are really committed to prioritizing family life. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing to see. So it's just, it shores us up when we hear other people actually are living that life. Right? I want to read a very short poem out of your book by author Joseph Pierce. He wrote it when he was 9 years old. It's called The Hedgehog. I am a hedgehog. In hedges I roam. I eat mostly insects. The shrubs are my home. I'm a curious creature hugging the ground, and when people seek me, I am quickly found. For rather than hide, I make myself round. It's beautiful. I love it. Nine years old.
Bonnie, I do so many interviews, it's difficult to make me blush, but reading a poem when I was 9 years old is guaranteed to do it.
It's adorable. It's actually remarkable for a 9-year-old. Do you write poetry as an adult?
Oh, yeah, I love writing poetry. I don't do it very often because poetry is something you need time and space for and silence. Mm-hmm. And I don't have enough of that. And when I do have time and space and silence, I do tend to, as I say, watch the sunset, spend time with the family, or read a book. So I have published one volume of poetry called Divining Divinity. And I've written several more poems since then. So I would like perhaps to bring out a new edition of the poetry I have written, but it's probably not more than 20 or 25 poems in total.
Okay. I have tried so many times to write poetry, and it always sounds so trite that I think, how is it that I can read so much poetry and appreciate it, and yet to get it down on paper, it just doesn't really work for me. I'll keep trying, though. I will keep trying.
You know what I really enjoy, Bonnie, and when it happened a couple of times, I've been commissioned to write a poem on a particular topic for a particular book. Okay. So there was a bring out a volume of poems on the moon. So I was asked to write a poem with a moon-related theme. And I actually wrote a poem called Diana Expectant. You know, Diana, of course, is the Virgin goddess, and the Diana Expectant. I watched Diana Expectant. She's expecting the sun, and it all becomes connected metaphorically with the Blessed Virgin. But the other one, which was even more challenging, was that there was a volume of coming out on the theme of cotton. And I thought, well, how does one write a poem on the theme of cotton? And and I love the challenge. It's one of my favorite poems I've written was the poem I wrote on cotton. So, you know, there you go.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I'd love to read that. And you do. You
and
work
of course, it's theological. It becomes theological.
I was just going to say. Yeah, Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This has been wonderful, and I really encourage my listeners to get this book. A beautiful gift book. Put it on your wish list if you can't. It's not something you can afford right now. Just in a remarkable collection and a remarkable way to sort of educate yourself as well. So I strongly encourage you to get it. I'll put the link to it in the show notes. Thank you again, Joseph. This has been absolutely beautiful.
Bonnie, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me. God bless you.
Okay. God bless you.